State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. We want to welcome all of our guests that are here today to observe the court proceedings. We have three oral arguments scheduled for today, and I'm sure you've had an opportunity to read through and see the booklets that have been passed out. I do want to welcome, we have several schools that are here in attendance today. The Hewlett School, the Upton High School, Pinedale Elementary, fourth grade from here in Rapid City, the Hill City High School, the Hot Springs High School, and New Underwood High School. So welcome to all of you, and I hope you enjoy the opportunity to see the court at work and see the attorneys that will be presenting arguments to us this morning. So with that, the first case set for today is a State of South Dakota versus Amanda Rose Hernandez. On behalf of the plaintiff appellant, State of South Dakota, I understand Sarah Thorne will be arguing, and also appearing are Lindsay Quasney and Katie Mallory on behalf of the state. On behalf of the defendant appellee, we have Mr. Tim Whalen, who's appearing and will be arguing today. Each side will have 20 minutes to present your initial arguments, and then Ms. Thorne, you'll have a 10-minute rebuttal as the appellant. There is a small box up here that will light up, 2-minute warning when it goes yellow, so you can kind of keep an eye on that. I'll try to warn you if you're getting close. With that, Ms. Thorne, you may proceed with your initial argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Whalen. This is a child murder case. Amanda Hernandez has been charged with the death of her 3-year-old daughter, A.H., who was severely beaten to death. And in preparation for trial, the trial court here made a ruling that the state believes was improper, and this court has agreed to hear arguments on that issue. The primary issue before the court today is that the defendant is claiming that the real killer who may have beat her child to death could have been a 10-year-old boy referred to by his initials NM, who was a son of her friend and who was in the home on the day that AH died. Amanda Hernandez asked the trial court if she could hire a psychologist to testify to state that because NM grew up in a home where domestic violence took place, then he has the inherent mental capacity to commit homicide. The trial court said that this testimony about the boy's mental capacity is both relevant and admissible, and the psychologist can testify in support of his theory as to several confidential records of NM's, including his counseling records, school records, DSS records, and his parents' criminal files. Here's what we know about the rules applicable to this issue. We know that all defendants have a constitutional right to present a defense against themselves. The defendant is allowed to show that someone else could have committed the crime for which they are charged. That someone, in this case NM, is referred to as a third-party perpetrator, and evidence pertaining to third-party perpetrators cannot be excluded outright. We know that firm rule, and the state does not disagree with that rule or challenge that rule. But following this constitutional right is the qualifier that the third-party perpetrator evidence must be both supported by law and have some foundation in the evidence. We know that third-party perpetrator defenses are admissible. We have many opinions by this court saying so. We do not have clearly established law in two areas which are relevant to this case, and that is first, how we treat what some courts refer to as reverse 404B evidence, and that is evidence of other acts of a third-party perpetrator presented by the defendant, and also whether a third-party perpetrator's other act evidence can be presented by an expert witness when that testimony or when that evidence is otherwise inadmissible propensity evidence.
This is a little bit off the issues in front of the court, but has the state offered or made any motions to offer 404B evidence in the case as it relates to Ms. Hernandez?
Yes, they have.
And you know what type of evidence that is? That's
yes, there were two other acts that the trial court has permitted to be presented at trial regarding the defendant, and those pertain to the victim, AH in this case, violence against the victim, and also another incident involving the defendant's other child.
So that's the extent of the state's 404B evidence?
To my knowledge, yes. There were other acts that were presented to the trial court that the trial court excluded.
Thank you.
Summarizing the law that we do have in this case, beginning with Luna in 1985 and continuing through Patterson in 2017, this court has held that third-party perpetrator evidence must, like all evidence, be first relevant, pass the 401 relevancy test, and must also pass the 403 balancing test. And in most situations, this court has stated that third-party perpetrator evidence must also show some sort of connection to the crime, usually specifying a motive, proximity, or opportunity to commit that crime. So briefly, applying that three-part test to the evidence in this case, first we look at relevancy. The trial court stated that this expert's testimony is relevant because the court stated that the jury must decide whether or not NM committed this crime, and also stated that the expert's testimony will explain to the jury a critical aspect of the defendant's defense. But the law does not ask us to do a relevancy test for a theory of defense. The law requires that we perform a relevancy test for each proposed item of evidence. So the proper answer to the relevancy question pertaining to this evidence and what the state advocates here is exactly what this court said in State v. Ray.
I'm sorry, Ms. Storm. So is your argument here that this isn't a fact, an issue, because it's one that the defense has raised as part of its defense? So therefore, it's not a fact, an issue. It's not subject to being relevant or cannot be relevant.
The state's stance here, yes, is that this third party perpetrator child's state of mind or mental capacity is not a question for the jury.
I thought I heard you say earlier, and maybe it's not a big difference, but I thought I heard you say and read in your brief that the issue of whether NM killed AH is not a fact, an issue.
That's correct.
And you may well be right that that's not what the jury is going to be asked to do. But isn't it part of in the nature of the third party perpetrator defense, at least in general principles, which you acknowledge that the defense exists, and you even acknowledge that there is a modest amount of evidence in this case that could come in that regard. Why is that not a fact, an issue?
It's not factual at all. This is a psychologist's theory that was manifested in order to connect some alleged other acts to this victim or to this crime. And in fact, the expert's testimony, as well as the other acts that the expert is relying on, do not show any connection between NM and AH or NM and this crime. They don't reveal any amount of hostility toward the victim. They don't show his state of mind on that date or anything that we've seen even moderately similar in other cases, in third-party perpetrator cases.
Counsel, it was my understanding from the record that the state attempted to have the trial court in one of the pretrial hearings or the motion hearings hear direct evidence of the alleged other acts upon which the expert is relying upon. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And the court declined your request to do that?
That is correct.
And I'm trying to understand what the court is intending to do by virtue of its ruling here with regard to the state's ability to then inquire or present other evidence regarding the reliability of those other acts. What is your understanding of the procedure that the court is intending to allow by virtue of its current ruling?
That's an excellent question. So yes, the state, once this other act evidence was deemed admissible, The state wanted to validate the foundation of some of that evidence because most of these records are, they include second or third removed hearsay and often come from testimony of young children or persons no longer recalling or present. Or so, yes, the state asked that the state be able to validate some of the allegations and some of these other acts. And the trial court said no. And the trial court stated that the expert would be permitted to testify about these other acts in front of the jury. And if the state would like to challenge the foundation of any of those statements, the state would need to challenge it then and have a discussion outside of the presence of the jury. And any remedial measures would be corrected with a jury instruction.
And by remedial measures, was there a discussion or what is your understanding of what the court was suggesting the remedial measure would be if it was determined that there wasn't sufficient evidence or the reliability of these other acts were called into question?
I am not a litigator, but in my mind, the only thing I can imagine is the court would tell the jury to please disregard that statement or that other act information that the expert presented in front of the jury.
But not the expert's opinion.
Apparently not the expert's profile or character opinion. Correct.
So the state loses twice, at least twice. They lose with the decision to admit the evidence, the propensity or the profile evidence. They lose again when the specific instances that form the basis for the opinion occur, and maybe lose a third time because they can't challenge the specific basis upon which the opinions are founded.
Exactly. There were multiple instances where the state tried to tackle this proposed evidence at just about every stage, and that has been shut down at all attempts.
So, counsel, just to clarify a couple of points from the record. First, you're not bringing a Daubert challenge on appeal. And thank you. And then second, there is an alleged other act involving an alleged assault upon NM's sister JM. What is the genesis of that information? Is it a police report? Is it a witness statement? What is the genesis of that statement in the record as I look through the record?
It originated with some kids playing outside, I believe, and it this fight between brother and sister was brought to the attention of a neighbor, to the best of my recollection. And again, the state asked that they be able to question that witness and verify the validity of this claim that NM was beating up his little sister. And that request was also denied.
But there's a narrative report in the record. I shouldn't say report. There is a narrative, a typed up narrative of that incident. It's not clear to me where that narrative report came from. Are you aware, or is there somewhere in the record that?
I am not. I'm not aware.
So there's kind of two parts to, as I view it, so the expert's opinion. There's these specific incidents that the expert ties into what I'm going to say sort of as a profile of the child in him. And then the first part is sort of developing that profile of child growing up in a domestic home that's violent and some of the characteristics that a child may develop as a result of viewing and seeing a violent home.
Correct.
Is that a fair assessment?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So moving to what I would say is that part of the opinion about the profile. How is that different than let's say taking a child sex abuse case and the state brings on an expert who talks about perpetrator evidence and says, you know, it starts with grooming and these are some of the characteristics and sort of that profile of a pedophile and the use of it being to educate the jury that somebody could actually commit these acts and do that. And that's, how is that different than what Ms. Hernandez wants to do here?
That's an excellent question. In situations where that type of syndrome or profile evidence has been submitted thus far, it is always pertaining to the defendant or the victim to allow the jury to get a better picture of, or to allow the jury to be able to decide the fact and issue. And usually that only occurs when an individual's state of mind is a direct issue for the jury. So for example, I'm just drawing a blank right now. I'm sorry. but usually, so for example, this court addressed that in State v. Logue when the victim's sexual knowledge was not an ultimate issue in front of the court. And again, this court went through those things in Buchholz and Burtzleff also, but they always pertain to victim state of mind. Here, this is a third party perpetrator where we have no other connection between this victim and this third party perpetrator other than the fact that he was in the home at the time. And so if you're looking at it with regard to whether this type of evidence would be permitted for the state to bring this type of theory for Amanda Hernandez, it would be strictly inadmissible in most situations because that's the definition of propensity evidence. This suggestion that because one has acted in a violent manner previously, then that individual is more likely to act in a violent manner in this situation.
I wondered if it wasn't, you could be right in terms of the distinction that you've made here in response to the Chief Justice's question, but I wondered if maybe the distinction between the class of cases that, that you two were talking about maybe isn't even the type of evidence or the identity of who it's directed at. I mean, maybe it is, but maybe it's what you said earlier. Maybe it's just the quantum of evidence that would connect it or doesn't connect it. So for instance, in Huber, the well-trained police officer, well, there was evidence that he was a well-trained police officer.
Mm-hmm. Again, that pertains to the defendant.
Well, it does. But even if it didn't, the evidentiary connection between the evidence and the person whom, you know, is the subject of the testimony involves evidence. And as you said earlier, in your view, in the state's view, there's no connection between NM and a history with this small child or doing anything this violent.
Yes, we don't. We don't have that factual evidence connecting the two here. So it helps in my mind to think, to review the evidence in other third party perpetrator cases that this.
Because we don't have a case that says what you're saying. Maybe you're right, but we don't have a case that says, hey, it's got to be directed at the defendant or the victim. We don't have that case. I don't think we could, you can infer that from the cases, but I wondered if maybe the easier rule isn't just that, hey, I mean, whether that class of evidence is off limits or on limits doesn't really depend upon who it's directed at. It depends upon the rules of evidence and whether you've got a sufficient connection.
That is very applicable here. This type of evidence fits the exact definition of Rule 404B1. This is evidence proposed for the purpose of showing that because someone acted in one way in the past or in other situations, then they may have acted in the same way here. I think it is helpful to look at the People versus Gonzalez case cited in our brief, and that's the only situation that I could find where the defendant is proposing an expert psychologist's opinion as to the third-party perpetrator's state of mind or likelihood that he or she may have committed the crime. And in that case, the court ruled that it was pure character evidence. This argument that the third party perpetrator may have internalized abuse that she experienced as a child was strictly inadmissible. The court determined that that evidence, like the evidence here, was not relevant to the question in front of the jury. It was both weak and speculative, which is also very similar to what this court stated in State v. Ray in 2009, when it stated that a third party perpetrator's mental capacity is not a question for the jury. And that's what we're dealing with here also.
For 404B purposes, does it make a difference or is there any more probative value in this case? Because we're talking about a 10-year-old kid versus an adult that people know adults can do bad things, commit crimes, and maybe think less that way about a 10-year-old. Does that make this evidence more relevant in this case? Because we're talking about a child versus an adult.
I don't think so, because there's still not that direct connection, nothing tying NM to this victim here, or nothing showing any amount of motive. It, in my mind, it makes the state's argument slightly stronger here, because we're talking about potentially admitting very detailed information about NM and his private life in front of a jury. Documents that are inherently confidential. I mean, his counseling records and such are things that I assume he never would expect to be on trial in a matter in which he is not charged.
You're just under 2 minutes.
Thank you. Again, we touched on it briefly, but it is important to note that this information, when looking at the 403 balancing test, the court performed the test based on NM's privacy interests versus the defendant's desire to present this evidence. And that's not the correct balancing test to make here. The court must have weighed this evidence against the state's need to present orderly and efficient trials. And this case is the perfect example of how that test has failed. This is now 2.5 years of pretrial litigation based largely on NM and his private life details and this expert's testimony, which again are not a direct question for the jury. And again, there's no connection between those other acts and the victim here. In the court's conclusions of law number 50 and 51, it directly stated that this information on its own is pure propensity evidence. And that's why the court said it would not allow any witness testimony as to these other acts. And then in the following conclusion of the law, it stated, but such prejudices to the state do not exist if we permit this under an expert's testimony. And as cited in our brief, there are several jurisdictions that clarify that otherwise inadmissible propensity evidence cannot be made admissible strictly under the cloak of an expert's credentials.
Can you draw our attention to the cases you're referencing specifically, if you have them handy? If not, I'll look in your brief.
People versus Gonzalez is the biggest one. Also, Lynn v. Fossum, Supreme Court of Florida, stated that allowing the presentation of otherwise inadmissible propensity evidence places an aura of scientific truth.
Your time's up. If you want to cite any other cases, why don't you cite those? And then
that's all. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Whalen, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. Yesterday, I was obviously frantically preparing for my oral argument. And everything was floating around in my mind. There's stacks of paper here. There's briefs. There's documents everywhere. So I took a walk. And on the course of my walk, it dawned on me that what is going to happen here is the real issue. The serious issue is going to get lost in the complexity of the litigation. What is that issue? I've practiced 34 years, prosecuted and defended criminally. In that time, I defended an 11-year-old who viciously and brutally beat a toddler in diapers to death and stuffed her in a closet, only to be found days later. I defended an adult who had, as a juvenile, killed another person when my client was 12 years old. I can't tell a jury this. I can't tell a jury exactly what I told you. So how am I supposed to convey to the jury that brutality and violence knows no age boundaries? Dr. Stokes. Dr. Stokes under Guthrie and Huber is how I convey that fact to the jury, because I can't put a witness up there to say a 10-year-old can do this crime. And while all of us in here in the legal field may understand that brutality and violence has no age limits, common people on the jury who don't have litigation and don't have legal backgrounds will look at it in disbelief and cannot fathom the fact that a 10-year-old may be able to brutally beat a toddler to death.
How do we know that?
How do we know that? We don't know for sure, but it's a conclusion that we can reach because they don't have that training. Their training consists of television, what they read in the papers. Their training consists of their education as an engineer or perhaps as a teacher or no education as far as in the professions and a construction contract.
The circuit court had a similar, and you're drawing upon it, Mr. Whelan, undoubtedly here. The jury had the judge had a similar view, of course, in which he says, I think the primary concern, summing up your argument, is you're worried that a judge would say, how could a young person engage in such a horrible act? Exactly what you're arguing here. But that's not a rule of admissibility.
But
we have things all the time that juries may wonder. They may wonder if insurance is available to pay damages. They may wonder any number of things and write them down during deliberations. And the trial judge will oftentimes say, I can't tell you the answer. Just work on the stuff that you've got. Work on the evidence that you've got. They wonder things all the time. What is it? And that's not, you still have to satisfy the rules of evidence. That is not itself a rule of evidence, and that itself, it seems to me, could not justify the admission of this evidence.
But that's the purpose of an expert witness, and that's what justifies it, and that's what gets it to the evidentiary rules. When juries may not understand the concepts and they need assistance from an expert, then the court can allow an expert. And here, that's what Dr. Stokes does, because all of the things that the state has argued and has talked about in this case has never been dealt with by this court before. Because you've never had a situation where you have an expert in behavioral analysis, such as Dr. Stokes, who can come in and he can say, I have reviewed the records. I've reviewed this evidence. I've reviewed these documents. I've viewed videotape interviews of NM and of other kids involved in this. And he can say, because there's science out there that says this is something that needs to be explained to the jury, the trial court properly looked at it and said, this is a concept that needs to be understood. Domestic violence and how it affects a young boy or a young child. And the science is there. The state says this is not science related and it's outside the rules of evidence. That's not correct. The science is there. I introduced 9 different articles of supporting Dr. Stokes's position. Dr. Flynn, the state's own expert, agreed that there is strong science about the effects of domestic violence against or on children.
Mr. Whelan, I'm going to just interrupt you there because this kind of goes on to the other part of the opinion that it appears you're offering here through Dr. Stokes is not just that a child who has been subjected to domestic violence can go on to exhibit these sorts of behaviors, but you're going further then to elicit the opinion from the expert that this particular child, based on particular patterns of behavior or prior other acts, can or has the capacity to exhibit this particular behavior. So that's going another step further. Is that a fair characterization of what you are offering here?
No, it's exactly Guthrie. And the state was allowed to do exactly what you described in Guthrie. They were allowed to bring on the psychological autopsy to rule out suicide. And in Guthrie, Justice Konenkamp determined that the error was to let that expert say that the victim was not killed by suicide, did not die by suicide. And that was the harmless error that was determined in Guthrie. Everything else above that was exactly what you said and what I'm doing with Dr. Stokes here. And it was all permitted from the state standpoint when it was beneficial to the state's case.
But counsel, aren't you asking that Dr. Stokes be permitted to opine that NM had the capacity to kill AH based
No.
on the evidence in the record? That is the second and final conclusive point of his opinion.
It is. But Judge Anderson specifically indicated that in accordance with Guthrie, that the whether or not the acts were consistent with behavior, not that my expert, Dr. Stokes, can opine that he did kill or that he did, in fact, engage in the actions to kill. That's not what Judge Anderson ruled.
Not that he killed, but that he had the plausible capacity to kill AH. That is the opinion that has been admitted thus far.
That he has his actions in accordance with what Guthrie says, as far as the Guthrie ruling is that the symptoms and the behaviors are consistent with the type of conduct that could result in AH's death. That is what I understand the trial court's ruling to be. Not that NM actually killed AH.
When you got up here right away, you started talking about how, and this gets to Justice Kern's question, your opening was about how can you explain that a 10-year-old child is capable of doing this? And I read, as Justice Kern did, I read Dr. Stokes' testimony to be that he's capable. And I'm going to say, based upon my work, that he has that capability. That's one question. But my other question, I guess, is this, if that's right, is that the extent of it? Is it just that he had the capacity, or is it that he had a greater capacity than any other 10-year-old child? And if it's that, why isn't this just pure propensity evidence?
Because we have to look at, in this particular case, Dr. Stokes, you have to dissect Dr. Stokes's opinion and his comments at the Daubert hearing. And he indicated that there's a two-part inquiry. There's a profile. Does NM fit the profile based upon science, based upon what's out there as absolute science in this field recognized by the experts? The second step is, do those behaviors fall within symptoms, a pattern of conduct, and a style of conduct, which is consistent with what could be a modus operandi? And so the second inquiry goes beyond the mere, does he come from his history of a domestic violence background? Is there domestic violence in his home? Second question is, what behaviors has he indicated or manifested and shown because of that exposure? And that's where Dr. Stokes says you can rule out all people, most people, by the profile. You look at their profile, which is consistent with psychological autopsy for suicide. It's consistent with sexual abuse. It's consistent with other sort of expert syndrome type and behavior type cases. And Guthrie and Huber's both confirmed that. And so he goes to the next step and he says, now, while we have the behaviors which show there are effects directly from his being exposed to domestic violence, what facts are there? And that's the second step that we go with the evidence is, what do we look at with NM? We look at this for 2.5 hours, NM was in the home alone without adult supervision, had been up most of the night watching Mortal Kombat, had also beaten his sister in the report that you asked, Justice Devaney. That was my private investigator who created that narrative. And he's the one that went out and talked to that particular person who witnessed and saw NM brutally beat and hit his sister while she was on the ground. Then you look at the tape from Child's Voice where NM was interviewed. And when the forensic interviewer asked NM about discipline at home, he immediately stopped and he said, cut off the interview, put his head down. When she tried to press forward with more questions, he got up and the 10-year-old had the audacity to leave an adult room in a room by herself and he stormed out of the room. That's what the videotape shows. And that is the evidence that leads Dr. Stokes to conclude that there is direct effects on NM. Add to that the fact that NM's dad brutally beat his NM's mother in the presence of the children.
Mr. Whalen,
go ahead. No, go ahead.
You can finish your question.
In Guthrie and in Huber, suicide was in the case, at least as a potential. Being a well-trained police officer was in the case in Huber. And I know that you just recounted some other instances and that's part and parcel of what you want admitted here. But to Ms. Thorne's argument, and to maybe your simplicity argument that you mentioned earlier, what evidence is there here? What evidence, other than the space of time where he was in the home, what evidence is there that would connect or suggest that this boy killed this child?
And to answer your question in two or three aspects. One, there is no physical evidence tying any person in that home to the death of AH. There are no eyewitnesses. The last person from the evidence that I've seen to see AH alive was NM. He walked through the room and he said that AH was whimpering and crying in his words. And he said, don't worry about it. Mom will be home soon. But just before that, he said, Mom was home and sleeping in the living room. He lies. He had access. His motive is established by virtue of his behavioral background as established by Dr. Stokes. So that puts him in the house. He's there unsupervised. He watches Mortal Kombat, which is, in my opinion, has a direct effect on his behaviors. He's unsupervised. He doesn't come from a structured home. He knows no boundaries. He's brutally beat on a child before.
So those are the things you were just recounting. And I have your argument on that.
And then, to add to that, you have the 2.5 hour time lapse, which when the adult returns home, Sydney, who's supposed to be watching the child, when she returns home, she lies to the officers, the investigators in the case. And then my client actually lies to them. You have...
Mr. Whalen, I don't want to run out of time before being able to ask you some of these questions, but a lot of what you've just been related will come into the trial through direct evidence, will it not? The timeline, when this happened, and it's my understanding the state intends to put NM on as a witness. So all of that comes in anyway. What we're talking about here is the expert testimony and what comes in through using the expert as a conduit. Did you move to admit as direct evidence? Let's specifically talk about the other act where NM was alleged to have beaten up his little sister.
Yes, I did. And I believe that the court allowed that to a certain degree, if I recall the record correctly. And you're correct, Judge Justice Devaney, that information will come in direct evidence. But I still have the hurdle to come over and surpass when I'm presenting my defense to the third party perpetrator defense to the jury, that I don't have to prove that NM killed AH.
But
I do have to show that there was motive, opportunity, and those things in order for it to be admissible.
The circuit court's ruling, as I understand it, is that these other acts cannot come in as direct evidence. And the court makes a ruling finding that that would be, although there might be some relevance, it would be unduly prejudicial. And then in the same ruling or set of rulings, then turns around and says, but this can come in through the expert testimony, however, as foundational evidence for the expert's opinion. And that appears to me that's, I'm struggling with that because that seems to be inconsistent. So how do you reconcile that ruling?
My understanding of Judge Anderson's ruling, Justice Devaney, is that I cannot get into specific details of what is in NM's school records, counseling records, or other documents that the judge, by the way, viewed in camera extensively before he released those to the other to the attorneys. So my limitation is I can present Dr. Stokes' testimony from an opinion standpoint, but I can't go into detail. The judge specifically told me I cannot go into detail as to those factual matters. I can only generally describe what he reviewed and what he looked at, but I can't go into detail. He specifically told me that. And if I do, the remedy, which is imposed by Judge Anderson, is that there will be a hearing out of the presence of the jury to examine those facts. My intentions and my understanding of Judge Anderson's ruling, I can't go into great detail and explain all of those records. I can't do that. I don't believe that's his ruling.
So you will not be calling a witness prior to putting the expert on to testify to this other act that related to NM and his little sister? Your understanding that you are not allowed to do that?
No, I am allowed to do that, but that is not the entire extent of Judge Anderson's ruling. That was a other acts, third party perpetrator evidence determination about the incident with JM, which is NM's sister. And there was a specific part of that I can't get into. There is this other part that I can't, but that's not the evidence that is crucial here as far as what the state is arguing is the other evidence. They're arguing the school records, the counseling records, and the incidents. I believe there was an incident on a trash can. Judge Anderson did not let me go into detail, and I can't go into that in detail. I can generally show that Dr. Stokes reviewed that information, but I can't go into specifics.
My understanding is Dr. Stokes is permitted to read that list of factual acts that NM allegedly engaged in as the foundation of his testimony.
That's not my understanding. My understanding is that I am able to identify that he reviewed school records, he reviewed counseling records, he reviewed these other documents, and that there were instances in there that led him to believe that his opinion is based upon this. But he can't go into specifics of those, is my understanding.
Instances that led him, he would have to recount for the jury what the instances were. He cut a child's hair, poked a child in the neck with a pencil, played games at killing games at recess, threatened students, etc. Are you intending to have Dr. Stokes articulate those factual predicates for his opinion?
On those particular instances, I am. I apologize.
That's the list.
That's
set forth in this record. And it's very clearly squared up in the findings as to what those factual predicates are.
And those factual predicates, I'm sorry, Justices, I may have misunderstood the question. I am going to go into those specific circumstances, but I can't go into the great detail associated with them as to the method of discipline or what else happened. Were there any other surroundings? It's what is provided from a general standpoint. But having said that, those particular acts are recognized by the science as what results from being exposed to domestic violence. So the science recognizes those acts as a basis for the subsequent behaviors of NM. So the science is directly related to that. Those are facts recognized by the science, and that's the distinguishing characteristic in this case. In these other cases, we're talking about a variety of things that may have occurred. They're not supported by the facts when you talk about...
I'm sorry, you're almost out of time here, but when you refer to the facts, that's the essential premise for the expert testimony, is it not? That he's relying on facts. So how does a jury then assess and determine to weigh an expert testimony if they don't know whether the facts the expert is relying upon are actually facts?
Because the jury, under the rules regarding this, the expert testimony, the jury has to determine the validity, and they have to determine whether or not it's credible. And so those underlying facts, in the general sense, are relevant and important. But again, if a child has no...
How do they do that if this just comes in through an expert's testimony as opposed to direct evidence?
Because the expert explains that when a child has no problems at home and he cuts a child's hair at school, it's not necessarily related to domestic violence. But when you add domestic violence, the science recognizes that act as a result of behaviors that are directly related to domestic violence exposure. And so it's the science that says the facts are important. And that's how the jury determines whether or not Stokes is credible, is he explains the science.
Your time is up, Mr. Whalen. Thank you. Thorne, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. The state is absolutely not saying that the science is not there. As we clarified, this is not a Daubert challenge. We are saying that the facts are not there. In regards to your questions, Justices Kern and Devaney, the ruling before the trial court and what the state intended to clarify is, yes, the court has determined that specifics about these other acts are allowed. The only limitation whatsoever is the court's language that the defense counsel cannot dwell on those acts, but specifics will be allowed. The contradiction that you referred to, Justice Devaney, between conclusions of Law 50 and 51, stating that direct evidence of this information prejudices the state, is confusing, is misleading, and then following that statement by stating that admitting this information through an expert eliminates those prejudices, is the court's direct admission that this evidence is pure propensity evidence.
So moving from the profile evidence I talked about earlier to the specific acts, let's take the expert out of the picture. Let's just say somebody comes in and is able to offer evidence on specific acts that NM did or perpetrated on other children, mm-hmm. violent acts, if there are any. Is that proper evidence in this case?
The evidence that we have in this case would not pass that bar. There's nothing showing direct identity or motive. There's nothing showing a reason that NM may have performed the same way in the past and then reiterated those acts in this instance. There's nothing showing he was angry or hostile toward AH. In fact, his only testimony is when she was whimpering that morning, wondering where her mom was, he went and got her a glass of water and attempted to comfort her. We agree, Justice Salter, that profile expert testimony goes to support the facts that are present in the case. And here we don't have those facts. It's helpful to look at other third-party perpetrator cases like Luna. The third-party perpetrator was an individual covered in blood seen at the crime scene. In other cases, it's first-person testimony witnessing another perpetrator at the scene of the crime. Or, for example, in Larson, it was a gunshot in the damaged vehicle. In Garza, it was multiple eyewitnesses seeing a third-party perpetrator at the scene. Those facts aren't present here. It's also important to note that if we're looking at the end of Rule 703 that permits an expert to testify to otherwise inadmissible evidence, that evidence still needs to pass the 403 balancing test, which it does not in the case.
So is the state of the view that none of Dr. Stokes' testimony is admissible?
Correct. None of it is relevant to the question before the jury, and none of it passes the balancing test. Because there's no factual evidence connecting NM to the crime, then this is sort of manifested testimony that may support Amanda Hernandez's defense in this case, but it is so far removed and confusing for the jury because it has the danger then of creating this impression for the jury that NM's mental state is a question for them to decide. And because it's admitted under the guise of an expert's credentials, it gives the impression, as this court has stated, of scientific truth, like it's not objectionable information.
Do you understand Dr. Stokes's opinions, as I described them in my question to Mr. Whalen, to be not just that NM had the capacity to do this, but that he had a greater capacity, that it was more likely that he would do this as compared to perhaps other peers who are 10 years old?
What a dangerous precedent to suggest and to establish.
But do you understand the opinion to really, because it talks all about he has the capacity to do it, and in a generic way, we want to show that a 10-year-old can do this. But does that really hold up? Is it that, or when you examine Dr. Stokes' testimony and the reference that he has with NM particularly in his opinions, is it just that generically a 10-year-old could do it? Or is that NM is more likely than another 10-year-old to do it?
I believe the conclusion there is that both of those things, and I guess when I compare it to Guthrie, as Mr. Whalen referenced, in Guthrie, it's a fascinating case, by the way, Presbyterian minister's wife is found dead in her bathtub, and the only question for the jury is, did she commit suicide or did the defendant commit homicide? And this court stated in that opinion that the only reason the expert's testimony pertaining to that victim's state of mind is because that was the ultimate issue for the jury, is suicide versus homicide. We needed to know that victim's mental state. And so that also included, in that case, some profile testimony as well. And this court said, first of all, that the expert's testimony pertaining to the victim's state of mind was only appropriate because her state of mind was an issue in front of the court. And this court has restated that in both Burtzleff and the Eighth Circuit has in Whiteplume also. State of mind evidence is only proper when a party places their state of mind at issue. And here that is not applicable. For example, in Ray, this court has clearly stated that once again, third-party perpetrator's state of mind is not at issue. So it's almost as if Amanda Hernandez here is attempting to fit this expert's testimony into both areas of Guthrie, which this court said is not permitted. If you believe that NM's mental capacity is an ultimate question for the jury, an expert's testimony cannot decide that ultimate issue for the jury. So there's no way it would pass both of those tests. Setting this massive record aside, when I think about it big picture, I view this proposed evidence as this warm apple pie severed into many different sections, one slice being Rule 401, one slice being Rule 402, 403, 404A, 404B, 702, 703, Guthrie, Ray, on and on, White Plume. And it's, in my mind, no matter which slice you pick out of that pie, every one of those is poisonous, because apparently this pie was baked by the Wicked Witch. But this evidence can and should fail the test of admissibility under all of those rules. And what the state is proposing here is nothing outlying any of those other rules, including case law. What it's asking this court to do is to toss that pie aside, rebake the pie, and just state that third-party perpetrator evidence presented to a jury cannot be otherwise inadmissible propensity or other acts evidence, and especially cannot be admitted under the guise of an expert witness's testimony.
Aside from, and I understand your argument as to what is or is not an issue before the jury, can you compare the evidence underlying the expert's opinion in Guthrie to the type of evidence, if that's the right term, underlying the proposed expert's testimony in this case?
If I remember correctly, the evidence underlying the expert's opinion in Guthrie was information all pertaining to the victim's suicidal tendencies. Again, very important that that pertained to the victim in that case and not a third-party perpetrator, but I don't want to misspeak, but it may have been factual information about her medical history. I know it had to do with her behaviors up to her death. So the court analyzed information like her, statements she had made to her children and things she was looking forward to.
Did that come in through witnesses at trial? If you are aware, and in fairness, you would only be aware of that through the opinion. And I don't recall off the top.
I don't recall off the top of my head either. It may not have been. I'm not sure. So once again, as a summary, the state's asking this court to reverse the trial court's rulings, stating that this expert witness's testimony and the underlying other acts are inadmissible in Amanda Hernandez's trial, that this court states that third-party perpetrator evidence must have some sort of connection to the crime, so that that's clear for future trials, so this doesn't end up in multiple years of pretrial side litigation about this topic, and also clarify that an expert witness cannot serve as a conduit for otherwise inadmissible propensity or other acts evidence. If there are no additional questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That will conclude the arguments in this case. I want to thank counsel for your arguments and for your briefing. And we'll be in recess for 10 minutes.